Coming to you from the ancestral territory of the Anishinaabe and the area inhabited by the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation, this is Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and the natural world around us, seeking solutions, reporting on news and events, presenting positive alternatives, and highlighting the steps others are taking. We hope to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet. Christoph Spieler, author of Trains, Buses, People, an Opinionated Atlas of U.S. Transit. And Christoph, thank you and welcome to Earth Matters. I'm going to ask you right off the top, the Opinionated Atlas of U.S. Transit, why is that the subtitle of your book?
Well, we've built some very good, very effective, very useful transit that lots of people ride, and we've also built other transit that isn't as effective or as useful. So I thought it was really important to have a book that really talks about what makes the effective systems effective, and that doesn't just merely report the dry facts of, you know, in 1993 they opened 10 miles of light rail, but talks about what is it about that light rail that made it work? Which cities have really had successful strategies, and why have those strategies been successful? So it's a book that's willing to point out what's good and a book that's willing to point out what's bad.
And you don't pull any punches. You do outline quite up front some of the things that the worst transit systems in the U.S. Ouch, that's got to hurt some of the cities.
And I've written on all those systems. Part of what the book is that every photo in here is actually my photo. So I've been to all of these cities and seen them. And there are quite a few success stories. There's a lot of cities that have done good things, but I think it's really useful to look at those cities that haven't and understand why, so we don't repeat the same thing. And I think one of our biggest problems is just the way we think about and the way we talk about transit doesn't always lead to good outcomes. So I think if we have more intelligent conversations about transit, we will build better transit systems. And when we build better transit systems, we make people's lives easier and we reduce the environmental impact of cities.
Right. Now, I should mention also off at the top that the book is available through Island Press. Island has had a number of books and publications that highlight all kinds of aspects of environmental issues. And I'm very happy to see this one on transit. The book has three different parts. Part one, the role of transit in the U.S., such things as what does transit do well, the history of transit. So that gives you a bit of background. Then part two is basics of successful transit, and we'll delve into that in a little bit. And then the larger part of the book, the third part, are, as you say, metro areas, and you dive into them and analyze them and say what's good, what's bad, what's been historic about it, and sort of the development of that. So let's start at the beginning and let's talk about what transit does well. What's the advantage of having transit in our cities?
So number one, I would say that transit is at the heart of economically successful cities. That if you look at any major metropolitan area in the world that is a center of the economy, that's a center of commerce, it has a high ridership transit system at its core. And that's because transit is very efficient at moving large numbers of people. And ultimately, human civilization is created by putting people together. Putting people together creates culture, it creates ideas, it creates economy. And transit does a very good job of that. And I think it's worth thinking about that from the environmental angle as well, because transit has huge environmental benefits. An obvious one is just less use of energy. If we put 40 people on a bus, it will take less energy to move them than if each of those people is sitting in their own car. But the other one is use of space, which is actually, I think, an even bigger effect. Where if you think about that bus takes up the space of two or three cars, yet it carries as many people as 40 cars worth. And once that bus gets downtown, it doesn't need a parking space. And I have some diagrams in the book showing in car-oriented areas just how much of our space is taken up by cars. Now, I like pointing out the idea that the average office worker has more space assigned to their car in the parking garage than they do to themselves in their cubicle. And so if we use transit, if we build places that are suited to transit, and we provide high-quality transit, we can accommodate the same number of people, the same amount of economic activity in less space. And that means people don't need to travel as far, which again saves energy. And it means we take up less space in developing our cities, which means we can save agricultural land, natural habitat, ecosystems, and dramatically reduce the climate footprint of those cities. The best thing we can do to reduce our environmental impact is build more urban places. And transit is what makes urban places work.
Right. And transit is available to everyone, all ages. You don't need a driver's license, so anybody 16 and under can use transit. Anyone that's lost their license or is a bit older, they can use it, so it's affordable. But there's also this negative connotation to transit riders. And tell me a little bit about that. What feedback did you get?
I mean, it's true that in some places transit is viewed as sort of the transportation of last resort. And obviously that in itself is an important function of transit. I mean, what you just pointed out, which is transit is there for everybody, whether they are able to drive or not, whether they can afford a car or not, if they are disabled, if they are young, if they are old. And transit gives everybody a basic freedom to move around. But in some places, you definitely have that connotation of only people who can't afford a car are riding transit. And I would say that that's a direct correlation to the quality of the transit, that places where we provide high-quality transit, lots of people use it. And when you have systems that are used only by people who essentially have no other choice, that's a sign that the service we're providing is poor, that if you run a bus an hour, which means that you have to plan your life around that bus schedule rather than that bus being there when you need it, people who have a choice will not use that bus. And we have found over and over again in all sorts of different cities that when you do actually provide high-quality transit, people use it. I mean, Houston is famously car-centric, but in downtown Houston, of the people who work downtown and live in the suburbs served by the park-and-ride bus system, half of them use transit. So if we provide good transit, people will use it. And every metro area has places that have the level of population density and the level of activity to really support that. And one of the key lessons in the book, too, is that's not just downtown. We need to be thinking about places like medical centers, like secondary employment centers, like universities. And connecting those together, those places exist everywhere and the demand exists. If we provide transit that's fast, that's frequent, that's reliable, people will use it.
You and other transit advocates talk about the transit system should not be designed to mimic or echo the existing road system. It needs to connect destinations.
Yes.
Like you said, the medical center to the university to the city hall. People need to have transit to go places, not just go, just down the road.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think one of the things that I think people make the mistake is they think they see a crowded freeway, for example, and they say, okay, that's where the transit needs to go. It's almost like they're thinking of like transit as a vacuum cleaner, and if you put it there, it'll vacuum up the traffic. But what you need to think about is not the path those cars are taking. You need to think about where they're going to and from. And one of the mistakes we make, for example, is we put transit in the middle of a freeway, and then at every one of those stations, you draw a circle around those stations of what can I walk to from that station? And it turns out half that circle is freeway, which nobody's walking to. Transit is fundamentally a pedestrian-oriented mode. Every high ridership transit system is based around people walking to and from transit. So transit needs to be in pedestrian-friendly places if it's going to succeed.
That's one of your major points, and you point out, and as you say, you take some pictures of places where it's awkward or near impossible to get to the transit. You've got to cross traffic to get to the transit stop, or there's no bus shelter in the windiest corner of the city, or,
yep.
You know, you might as well Or the opposite, you point out that some places the bus stop is at the wrong end of the building, in the back end of the building, when the entrance is actually on the other side. So talk about, you know, one of the things you talk about, connectivity and walkability. How important is it to have that walkability? People don't think about you've got to walk to the bus and you've got to walk away from the bus.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, even transit systems which are based on park and ride, somebody who's using park and ride will have a car only on one end of the trip. They will not own a second car that's waiting for them at the other end of their transit ride. So even park and ride systems are dependent on one end of the trip being highly pedestrian friendly. And you will not find a high ridership transit system in the book that depends for most of its ridership on park and ride, because it's actually not a very efficient way to get transit riders. That the space taken up by that one parking space in a parking lot would generate a lot more people if instead there was an apartment complex sitting right there.
Mm-hmm.
But that means that the transit experience is a door-to-door experience. And if somebody is going to ride transit, we need to make sure that door-to-door experience is good, not just the transit stop-to-transit stop experience, which means, for example, that sidewalks and crosswalks are an integral part of a transit system, and we need to think of them that way. It means that we need to think about how we build buildings. I mean, in Houston, there's a brand new hospital which was built next to a bus stop, and they literally put a moat between the bus stop and the building. So you have to walk a couple hundred feet out of your way to be able to get from the bus stop to that building. That dramatically influences that transit experience. It makes that transit less useful. And for everything I just mentioned, our basic standards are a lot lower than they are for cars. Like, we got to a point a long time ago at which we decided that every street is going to be paved. You know, when they build a new street or maintain an existing street, nobody runs a cost effectiveness to decide, you know, is there enough traffic on the street to justify pavement, or should it maybe just be dirt or gravel? In every city has made the decision we're going to pave all of our streets. Very few cities have made the decision that we are going to have a sidewalk on every street. We are going to have a crosswalk at every intersection. We are going to have a shelter at every bus stop. So we're neglecting some of the basics of what makes transit work. And the good news is everything I just mentioned is cheap. That's really cheap compared to building new freeways. So that if we wanted to do this stuff, we can do it pretty easily and pretty quickly and make the transit experience much better.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You also, you touch on one thing, the fact that when people are looking at transit and they see a half-empty bus go by, or I never take the train, they're so car-centric that they don't understand that our taxes are also going to pay for that pavement and the upgrade and the sewers and everything else that are underneath it. So as much as people want to complain that transit is being subsidized by government, they seem to have this blind spot that everything else is subsidized by government as well, or at least it comes out of our taxpayer dollars. So
yeah, exactly. I mean, the kind of subsidy we see for transit systems, roadway systems have a very similar or much higher system of subsidy. I mean, if you think about local roads, for example, are typically not funded from gas tax, which means local roads are 100% subsidized. Their fare box recovery rate is zero. And nobody ever thinks about it that way. And like you pointed out, even the way we think about it, people see a half-empty bus and they think that's a waste of government dollars. They see a half-empty freeway and they're really happy because it means it doesn't have a traffic jam. And guess what? That half-empty freeway, if the bus is a waste of dollars, then that half-empty freeway is a waste of taxpayer dollars as well. And so the way we talk about transit is very different than the way we talk about other means of transportation. And if you dig into that, there's definitely a big component of race and class in that. I mean, for example, if you think about how we talk about transit fare evaders compared to people who evade parking meters, there's not a single place I know of that criminalizes and arrests people because, you know, they parked their car at the meter and parked for 40 minutes and only fed the meter for 30. But it regularly happens on transit systems that We literally arrest people for jumping a turnstile. So we often talk and think about transit differently than we do about other modes, and that's a real problem.
Okay. Let's talk about connectivity. That always seems to be, from a transit rider point of view, that always seems to be the biggest concern or frustration, is the making the connections from, you know, one type of transit to another, or just, you know,
yes,
having to transfer onto another bus. So how important did you find connectivity in the community?
It's incredibly important. I mean, if you look at high ridership transit systems, they get a lot of their ridership from connections to other systems. We have a tendency to talk about transit one mode or one line at a time, but you look at a successful light rail system, and part of the reason why it has that ridership is because it connects really well to a bus system. And you look at cities like Portland, you look at cities like Minneapolis, and you will see that a huge part of Seattle, which is one of the U.S. cities that is growing transit ridership the most, a huge part of the success of those systems is the fact that they are rail systems and bus systems that work well together. And if you want to look at Canadian examples, the Toronto subway, for example, was built from the beginning with bus connectivity and streetcar connectivity designed into the stations. And that's what makes that system so effective, is that rail line becomes the backbone to a larger system and doesn't just connect you to the places that are on that rail line, but connects you to the entire city. And that means planning the systems together. It means designing bus networks that work well with the rail networks that that city has, which is surprising how many cities don't do that. It means having good physical transfer locations, and it means thinking about how you do fares. That, to me, free transfers are essential to a successful transit system. We shouldn't penalize somebody just because the transit planners didn't provide them with a direct route. And I would say the state of the art in that is, if you look at some places in Europe, Germany in particular, where fares are fully integrated among all modes. If you take the bus or the streetcar or the subway in Munich, the fare from point A to B is the same, regardless of which agency is operating that bus, regardless of which mode of transportation you're using, regardless of how many transfers you make. And you can simply buy a day pass or a monthly pass or a yearly pass that covers all of the transit in the city. If you have that piece of paper in your pocket, you can ride any transit you want as long as you stay within that zone. And when you do something like that, transit, the kind of feeling of freedom you get from that, transit becomes something that you can just count on to get you wherever you want to get without having to think about it much. And that's possible with multiple operators. I think in a lot of cities you see that problem, and I think the Toronto region has definitely had that problem. A lot of U.S. metro areas have had that problem where you have multiple transit operators that really don't coordinate much with each other. It's not multiple operators that are the problem. It's that lack of coordination. And you can do this well with multiple transit operators if they talk to each other and if you actually adopt a fare system that works together between all of it.
Sometimes I wonder if the city planners, the urban planners, even ever go on a bus or a commuter train. You know.
Oh, that's a huge issue. That the typical transit board, and never mind the typical elected officials, and even the consultants who design transit systems are often not transit riders. And I would argue that if you don't ride transit, you really don't understand what makes transit work.
It's a different mindset. It's not a case of, you know, if you get in the car, and I think you also mentioned it in your book, the fact that people don't calculate the fact that, oh, I need to go and get, you know, a loaf of bread, and how much time it takes to get into the car, and up here in Canada, scrape the snow off the vehicle, and then drive down the road, and then turn around, and then drive back. And the notion is that, oh, transit is way too slow, it takes too long, and the other thing is, and I'm not in control because it's some bus driver who I don't know is, you know, driving the bus, kind of thing. So does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. No, and I mean, and often there are definitely lots of cases where transit is slower, and that's because we've explicitly built those cities in a way that makes transit slower. That if we design places to be fundamentally car-oriented, they will be difficult to serve with transit. And land use and transportation are just completely related. And in places that are actually designed to make transit work, well, transit is often faster and is generally more reliable if that transit is operated well. I also think you just made another really important point, which is transit isn't just about getting to work. It is about things like getting to the grocery store, or going to the park, or going to the museum. And we often forget about that part of it. There's a lot of transit systems which are very oriented to 9-to-5 jobs. And I think commuter rail systems are the best example where it's even built into the name. You know, if you have that train could be used for lots of other things, but we tailor the service and the hours very particularly to one single purpose ridership. And if we really want to get the benefits of transit to how a city functions, to people's own lives, we need to make transit something you can rely on for all the things you need to do, not just for getting to work or to school. You know, if you think about the cost of owning a car, a lot of that cost is fixed. Simply driving less doesn't save you much money. And even if you think about the environmental impacts of a car, simply using the car less doesn't reduce the impact of the space it takes up. So if we make really good transit that's there for all of the trips you need, not just your getting to work, that's what really fundamentally changes things.
One of the things in your book that you talk about how to build a successful transit system is titled Legibility. So talk to us about that. That kind of took me a moment to absorb that. So tell us about legibility, how important the signage and everything else is.
Yeah, I mean it's something that is hardly ever talked about with transit. But number one, if you want to grow transit ridership, you need to get new riders. You need to have people who don't know the system already start to ride it. And number two, a lot of your current riders are not making the same trip every day. There's jobs like home health care aides who regularly have to travel to different places. But even outside of that, you know, if you want to go visit a friend you haven't visited before, if you want to go to see a museum you haven't been to before, you are riding a new transit route. And the question is, how easy are we making that on you? Can you find that transit stop? When you get to the transit stop, does it give you the information you need to be able to use it? Even the basic form of the system, the difference between a logical transit route that matches the street pattern, that runs on one street for a long distance so that you can easily conceptually understand it, compared to a transit route that sort of snakes around the city. And it's amazing how difficult many of our systems are to use. That just bus stop signage, if you want to take one very basic example. There's a lot of cities that on the bus stop, the only thing they show is the number of the stop of the bus route. They don't tell you the name of the bus route. They don't tell you where it goes. They don't even tell you which direction it is. You know, there's a westbound bus and eastbound bus. Which side of the street am I supposed to wait on to catch the bus that I need? And it's surprising how many times you won't get that information. And what we have found is cities that have done a good job of legibility. I give the example of the A line in Minneapolis-St. Paul, which is a bus route in regular traffic in which they simplified the route, built really nice bus stops, and provide really good passenger information at every bus stop. They got an immediate ridership boost just by doing that. And it's obvious if you start to think about it, but we don't do nearly enough of it. And that's one of those fairly easy things we can do to make a system easy to understand. So it's about designing the system in the first place to be logical, and then it's about providing the information that people need every step of the way. And I mean, smartphones are part of that. Google Maps has made using transit easier. But a good system shouldn't depend on that. A good system should have the signage to be able to do that. And it's also transfers. We talked about those before. If you're getting off a subway and you're going to transfer to a bus, on a good network, the moment you get off that subway car, there is a sign telling you which way to walk to get to the bus connection. And if there's multiple buses at a station showing you where all the different routes are, like, you should know every step of the way that you are headed to the right place. And that gives you a kind of confidence and assurance in using the system, as opposed to wandering around wondering, am I still in the right place? Am I going to the right place? Will I get there? And that kind of feeling of uncertainty, I think, really keeps people from riding.
Right. Quite right. We're running out of time, but I want to jump to the chapter where you talk about the best and the worst. And, you know, the title that sort of jumps out at me is the most useless rail transit line. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you note Nashville's Music City Star might be the worst that you came across. But tell us about your favorite transit system and where was that?
Well, I mean, number one, it's hard to beat New York City. Like, there are a few places which are as transit-centric as New York, and I'm not saying necessarily it's the best-run system. They have some real issues, but New York is a place where transit is truly useful. But a couple of cities I would really give credit to in terms of what they did post-World War II, newer cities, newer systems. I think Seattle is doing some great work. I think the Twin Cities are doing some great work. I think in Seattle they're doing a really good job of rail lines which really make trips a lot faster and tying the bus system to them and improving the basic bus system to make it a lot more useful. The Twin Cities did a great job of combining a frequent bus system with rail lines that really connect the most important places that work well together. And I would say in the United States, the city that has most transformed itself in the last 50 years is Washington, D.C., where they did a really good job of building a subway system that served the urban core well, but that also, as it went out into the suburbs, made a point of stopping at those centers, not just taking the easy path, but going to where concentrations of activity already were. And then all of those municipalities and counties made a real effort to develop around those stations. And you now have a city which pre-World War II had a fairly average transit system, which now has one of the best transit systems in the United States, where the city has grown around it, and everybody sees that transit network as a basic part of how that city functions. And, you know, if I look at Canada, I can say Toronto is a good example of that, another post-war subway that has really transformed that city. And Vancouver is an amazing story of a city that has really shaped its both urban and suburban development patterns around truly useful transit. And if you look at those cities, if you look at Vancouver, if you look at Seattle, what you're seeing is a huge amount of growth in both population and jobs without increasing traffic. And that's what good transit systems combined with good urban development can really do for you.
Christoph, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Earth Matters. I've been speaking with Christoph Spieler, author of Trains, Buses, People, an Opinionated Atlas of U.S. Transit, published by Island Press. Again, thank you for joining us and continued good success.
Thank you so much. Truly enjoyed it.
Christoph Spieler is Vice President and Director of Planning at Hewitt Zollars and a lecturer at Rice University Schools of Architecture and Engineering. You can find out more about Christoph and his book by visiting trainsbusespeople.org. Lawson Hunter here, host and producer of Earth Matters. I wanted to thank all the listeners of Earth Matters for your continuing support. As always, please feel free to send us your comments, suggestions, and thoughts on topics and people we should look at for future programs. I'd also like to encourage you to like, rate, and share Earth Matters with others so that our work can reach a larger audience. Thanks for listening.